Welcome along to the Go Play Soccer podcast with host Manchester United Academy coach Tom Statham. At Go Play, our aim is to bring people together from all across the world to discuss the beautiful game.
Tom Statham here, and today I am pleased to be speaking with three ladies who all have prominent roles in women's football on both sides of the Atlantic. Here in England, Charlotte Healy is the Manchester United Women's Academy manager and head coach of the under-21s. And over in the USA, we have Skye Eddy and Nora Maguire-White, both experienced and successful players, coaches, and coach educators who now run organizations that aim to make soccer a happy and rewarding experience for young players and their parents. Skye is the founder of the Soccer Parenting Association, and Nora is founder and CEO of the Steady Academy. Welcome, everyone, to the Go Play Soccer podcast.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks for having us on.
You're very welcome. So let's start over in America with Skye. Can you just tell us a bit about your coaching journey and specifically about soccer parenting?
Yeah, for sure. Thanks again for having us here. It's always fun to get some women in the game together. So I'm looking forward to this conversation. So I grew up as a player, played collegiately. I played briefly professionally in Italy, but I've always been a coach. Even since high school, I was coaching young goalkeepers, and really started in my coaching journey in college, where I worked extensively at goalkeeper camps that we had in the United States, and went on to coach in the college game and sometimes with our national team programs here in the United States. And I am now happily coaching a U10 team, which seems to actually be my favorite. I love these littles and all the learning that's happening in these moments. And so it's funny, after all of this coaching, to have settled on the U10 being my favorite. I'm a B licensed coach for US soccer. I'm a coach educator along with Nora here in the United States. We're grassroots coach educators and work for United Soccer coaches and doing their goalkeeping stuff as well. I founded Soccer Parenting because, like all of us in the game, as active coaches, we realize that there is a big disconnect between coaches and parents. There are a lot of different reasons for that. It's a very complex issue, but I decided to take it on. And so at Soccer Parenting, we're working to inspire players by empowering parents and really helping parents understand the power that they have to ensure that their child is inspired. This doesn't mean they insert themselves more. That means with appropriate boundaries, with proper education and guidance, support, and understanding about what their role is in the lives of their child's soccer journey, in order to make sure that their child maximizes their potential or just falls in love with the game.
So Charlotte, as the academy manager at Manchester United, the women's program there, how the relationships with the parents involved, because that's going to be pretty key to how the academy runs.
Yeah, it's actually a really big transition period for the parents, to be honest, because we have a under 10s to under 16s youth academy. And obviously at that age, parents are really heavily involved. And then they go from U16 to U21, which is obviously a 4 or 5 year age group jump. And then from the under 21s, it's straight to the first team. So it's a real challenge, and it's probably something that we've really evaluated over the past probably 18 months, if I'm totally honest, because I kind of went in with the stance of, you know, we need these young girls to be accountable. We need to give them responsibility. And I didn't do a huge amount of work with the parents, if I'm totally honest. And what I found was the girls actually dealt okay with it. It was the parents that really struggled, because they felt like they'd been, you know, responsible for everything. And then all of a sudden, the girls were training in the day. They were playing Wednesday afternoons. They couldn't get to all of the games. You know, it's a nationwide games program. So what I actually did was put a parent rep in place. And that parent rep now meets regularly with the parents. I meet him once a month. And it's been a really, really good way to enable parents to have a voice whilst making sure that, you know, I'm not being bombarded by parents 24/7. I think it was, like Skye said, really just putting out clear boundaries as to, this is the program, this is how we will support the girls. We want it to be high challenge. It will be high support. It's going to be difficult for them. You know, these are the challenges that the girls who've previously come through the academy have faced. And we actually asked a couple of girls to present to parents at the start of the year, which for the under 16 parents, sorry, in terms of around that transitional jump. So yeah, parents are huge, and I think, you know, they play a huge part in young people's lives. And I think, yeah, we're really starting to get the best out of that relationship now, you know, 3 years later, really.
Well, I'd love to hear that you all are, you know, connecting with parents, giving them a place in the journey. Because you're right, as a parent, from a perspective of a parent, you know, we care so much about our child, and we're uniquely positioned to support them as well. Things like mental performance. I mean, we know our child better than anyone else, and if given some tools, can really support. Have you kind of dove into that with parents at all, in terms of, you know, looking at them as a valuable asset in the development of the player as well?
Yeah, so what we did was a couple of parent workshops, probably not into the levels that you have, but what we started to look at was, well, what role can parents play? So we know, you know, there's always the difficult car journey home if they've not played well, those kind of things. So just little things around shaping conversation, around education for parents, around, well, what is a talent development environment? What does, you know, an elite athlete need from parents? Because, you know, they don't need the parents to ask them if they played well, you know, marking themselves out. They don't need all that. You know, they've got coaching staff to do that. And we've got, you know, our own ways and of supporting players in from a football aspect. But it's the, you know, how are you? Did you enjoy the game today? You know, those kind of conversations, because being part of this academy is really difficult. You know, so the girls they're very long days. They come in from all over Greater Manchester. They're in college all day. You know, or that if they graduate college, they work all day, then they come and train in, you know, like a late afternoon. They get back late at night. We could play 2-3 game weeks. We had, you know, and as an example, I know you might not know the geography, but we played Chelsea, Brighton and Man City away in 7 days, which, you know, is a huge amount of travelling. They've got exams, et cetera, et cetera. So it's really difficult. And I think it was what we were really keen to do was to educate parents around what it looks like to be in the academy. And then help support them in how they best support their child, deal with the challenges and the demands of it. Because you could have the best footballer in the world, but I personally believe that not everybody can deal with the demands of elite performance. And I think parents have a huge part to play in that.
Let's try and bring Nora in. What are your thoughts on the conversation so far, Nora?
Yeah, well, it's interesting. I was on the phone with a college coach earlier this morning and Sky and I spoke about this in recent days, so I'm really excited to be on. I love to learn, to continue to learn in my journey and be able to pass more information back to, you know, the players that I work with and the parents that I work with. But parent misinformation, and I think is a massive part of what goes on here in youth development. There's a perception, I think, that so many parents have, and maybe Charlotte, I'd love to hear from you or Tom about this. You know, my player is going to be, you know, the next Alex Morgan. My player is going to be the next this. And so I think a lot of parents come in and think, oh, this pathway, and I've got to make this club at this time and this team at this level. And then because I'm on this team now, my kid's going to get a college scholarship. And there's just, you know, my son plays on a 12-year-old playing on an ECNL, which is one of the higher level leagues over here, team. And I think, you know, listening to the parents at the very, very beginning, it's like they think their kid is right now on the path to, you know, get a Division I college scholarship and play for the University of Virginia, which is, you know, one of the really strong programs over here. And it's either that or failure, instead of, you know, the primary mission of STEADY, which I founded for the first time in 1998 after I left coaching at the Division I level, was, oh my goodness, there's so much development we're missing while we have these players as a captive audience doing the thing that they love. So can we empower them to grow holistically so that whether they remain on that journey to elite playing status, or the majority of them that don't make elite, you know, playing level, that they now have tools that can help them be successful in whatever they do pursue, whether it's lower level play or their profession, getting their degree, being successful in life. And so I think there's so much, it's great that I love just the collaboration of people that we have right now, because there's so much conversation to be had about how could we do a better job further educating and I think educating and giving skill sets and tools for both the parents and the players is only going to improve, you know, the end product, both of the preparedness of the elite player and also all the others that don't make that level.
Yeah, and Skye, what advice would you give to a coach that's faced with a parent like that, that comes in and with the expectations that their son or daughter is going to be the next big thing? How does a coach deal with a parent with this sort of unrealistic view?
Yeah, well, I think, Nora, you used the word like misinformation. Parents have this misinformation. And I think a lot of times parents have no information. And so they're just kind of going along with what they think is supposed to be happening or what the loudest voice on the team on the parent sideline is saying. And so that's actually, you know, foundational to the work that we're doing at Soccer Parenting is, you know, this is an education platform that, you know, trying to give parents good information, the proper information, so that they can be best suited to support their child. And what we find is that the vast majority of parents, and Charlotte, I would be curious, like, just for you to kind of think, like, what percentage of the parents on the teams that I'm working with are like what I would qualify as like the crazy parent versus like just the level-headed and stressed parent. And what we find is that the vast majority of parents are in fact level-headed and stressed, and that while all of us, if we have kids, we want them to, you know, fulfill their dreams and live up to their potential. But when we give parents guidance and information on what the research says about long-term athlete development and about, you know, what a high-performance pathway looks like and the ups and downs of that, when we give parents and provide them with information on that or even relative age effect, once parents see these things, then a lot of that stress is alleviated. So I guess that would be, Tom, my advice to coaches that are working with parents who have maybe misaligned expectations for their child. It's one thing if they're putting a lot of stress on their child, but if the parent is just misinformed, just simply by providing them some really good research-based information will put them on a path to better understanding, which will give their child the freedom to, you know, fully develop.
Yeah, that's great advice. And I mean, I've been going to the States a number of years, and I've seen how strong the girls' game is in America. And in England, by comparison, the game's been very weak, really, until, in my mind, sort of 5 years ago, something like that, maybe even sooner, 3-4 years ago, when all of a sudden it's gone absolutely crazy. And the standard and the organization in girls' football now is really matching the boys' level. For the first time in England. So has that level of expectation changed parents and their attitudes in your experience, Charlotte, working with young girls in this country?
Yeah, I think firstly, listening to both of you speak, it absolutely resonated with everything you said. Is, you know, we're in the same boat. And I think it's interesting because at United, obviously, they had a youth section 10s to 16s for you know, well-established, you know, 10, 11 years that had been running. Then they had a first team, which reformed in 2018. And then we put this academy in 2019, which was basically the bridge between the young girls and obviously a, you know, professional women's team. So absolutely, you know, what you were saying, Skye, around education of parents, that was key for us. And I think, you know, Manchester United is steeped in history on the boys' side of having, you know, graduates make the first team, et cetera, et cetera. And what we found was that the women's game had been through almost like a revolution of the 19, 20-year-old girls who are coming through now were taking the shirts of the 28, 29-year-olds who had come through a part-time non-professional system. So it almost set a false precedent that at 18, 19, you'll be making WSL debuts and getting pro contracts, where there was a big education piece around, well, hang on a minute, those girls who've come through, the 18, 19-year-olds who are now 22, 23, you know, when they're 28, 29, they're going to be in the prime of their careers. So the young players now coming through, it's almost a tougher gig for them. But I think one thing that we did, and I think we did really well, was around being really clear on what success for our academy is. And we did this right from the very off. So I'm talking 3 years ago. And it's interesting because I actually spoke with Nick about this the other day. And we've both...
Just to interrupt, Charlotte, Nick is Nick Cox, the boys' academy manager.
Yeah, correct. Yeah. So it's quite interesting that we've both done it different ways, but very similar, that the big piece for parents, for us and players was, you know, the success of our academy isn't just judged on a player going and getting a pro contract with the first team at Manchester United, because if that's what we hang our hat on, you then fail 95% of the players that come in your programme. So we were really clear that we measured success by, yes, can we get a graduate into the first team with a pro contract? So we've had two of those this year, which, you know, is an amazing for our academy. But we've also had players go and get professional contracts at other clubs, you know, go and play in the Women's Championship. Some actually, you know, might play tier three, but they've gone to university. And actually, I spoke to a player who left us 2 years ago, who's just qualified as a physiotherapist, which was her dream, you know, what she wanted to do. And, you know, genuinely, hand on heart, I genuinely mean this, that we are as proud of those players as we are of, you know, Carrie and Tara going in and getting a pro contract in the first team. And it's important that we celebrate that success and we celebrate and champion what they've done, you know, just as much as the other girls, because, you know, what for me as an academy manager, what I've always said is, all I ever want is in 5 or 10 years' time or 20 years' time is, you know, a player to look back and say that their time in our programme at Manchester United positively influenced their life, whether that's to go and play pro football, whether it's to go and have a dream career. You know, I feel as an academy and my staff feel the same, that, you know, we have a real huge part to play in that. And I think it's getting that across to parents that, listen, not every player in here is going to go and play on that pitch. They're not. And we're never, ever going to sell that dream, because that's not reality. So I think right from the front, you know, right from the very start, when they first walk in the door, that's day one. That's the induction evening, day one. This is how we measure our success. And it's being, yeah, really honest and clear. And also through, I think another, when you were talking, Sky, I was thinking about when we have player meetings. So we meet with players every 6 weeks. So then when they're in their final year, by like Christmas time, we have a real clear exit route strategy. So it's never like they get to May and you cut. It's absolutely not that. We change the terminology a lot. There was a real big piece of work we did around, we don't release players. You know, if they leave our programme, they graduate, because it's a celebration. You know, we got rid of retain release. We got rid of the word contracts, because they're not contracts. It was just a real clear piece around what terminology we're using, how do we educate parents, and how do we make sure we have the tough conversations with players and we're honest. And if that means, you know, telling them at Christmas that, you know, we're going to support them in their next move, but that's external to Man United, then so be it, because we owe it to every player. And I think later down the line, that makes things easier then in terms of transitions.
Yeah, I love it. Are those kind of across the level of academies in England, do you think, are changing, for instance, like the terminology that they're using and thinking about player wellness like this?
I'm not sure every academy does it, if I'm totally honest. We're really lucky. Obviously, we have, you know, a huge amount of players who want to come to us every single year. You know, and what we wanted to get away from was players feeling like they failed if they didn't get offered a registration the following year. So yeah, it was really important to us that we used the term graduate. We had a big celebration event of, you know, players getting, you know, shirts with their name and number on, and, you know, clips of what they've done throughout the year, just because it is a celebration and it's an achievement to be here. And like we said, they haven't failed, because the outcome wasn't to get a pro contract with the first team. We just wanted to be really clear about that, really.
Yeah. Tom, you're so right. Soccer, football has come so far in England for the women. It's so exciting to hear you talk that these opportunities are existing for women. I remember being in England coaching with my friend Steve. I was doing some goalkeeper coaching one winter. I worked with him in the States, and I was out there working with some boys. This was like in the mid 90s, and the dad's like screaming through the fence, "You don't have to listen to her. She doesn't know what she's talking about," you know, to me when I'm coaching the kid. And, you know, it was just so unusual to even see a woman in the game over there. So it's so exciting to see and to hear the growth of the game. So
yeah, awesome. I work in the foundation phase, the 8 to 11 year olds in the boys' academy. And there's the lead foundation phase coach at Preston North End in the boys' academy is actually a female, you know, good lady. So
things
are really progressing.
That was my question. Just going on a little further, I think it's the longer I'm in the game, the more I realize it has to do with proper organizational structures first. Mm-hmm. It's like, you know, it's, I think for a long time, I couldn't see back to the business side, because that carried a negative connotation to me early on in my coaching career as it pertained to the game. If you're, it sounds like in a little bit that I've looked at, I mean, how fast the growth of the game has jumped and all the resources that you now have at your disposal that look like they weren't there just almost pre-COVID or in COVID is just astounding. But it's amazing to hear you talk about the systems in place and, you know, parent reps, we call team managers over here. I think hopefully you get to wisely choose yours. Sometimes I never, when I was directing youth clubs over here, we never let somebody just volunteer for that role. We made a list and we proactively asked, would you be the team manager on this team? Because, you know, they can, the manner and the enthusiasm or negativity with which they communicate, even in the tone of an email, can really carry the day on the culture. But it's amazing to hear, because I think, you know, as coaches, when we step out, we have so much to do to put together our training sessions and think about development that it can be really difficult, I think, for coaches. And in many clubs, that most clubs in America that don't have massive resources, right? Most people are, you know, in what we do, we're stretched time-wise, and both collegiately and at the youth level, it takes the person having a passion for exactly how you, it's so amazing to hear you, Charlotte, talk about how you feel about measuring the successes, about whether it's somebody that's going to get their degree and becoming a physio or getting into things professionally, because for me, that's the key. We tend to, you know, define our success with winning, going on, getting to the next level, instead of that each player that comes in is uniquely special and has a gift, and if encouraged and well-developed, is going to reap great rewards, whether that ends up being in the game or in the world or whatever environment they get into. Charlotte, so my question to you is, do you feel like that decision was made as an organization on the Man United girls and women's side to give you the resources, and in the hiring process, obviously they've gotten the right person with you, and whomever you work with in hiring your staff, is that very deliberate in Man United on the girls' side? And sort of what Sky was at, do you feel that deliberately is done in other clubs in England with the women, as women's youth development as well?
Yeah, I mean, to be honest, I don't know about other clubs. I think we, in terms of the reason I moved to Manchester United in 2018 was that I knew Casey previously. She was our first team manager. Obviously, she's in San Diego now. She's 21 afterwards. But Casey was a player at Liverpool when I was the 23s assistant coach there. So I got to know her really well. We were both doing our A license at the same time. And I just knew I could tell how much she cared about the under 23 girls. You know, she said, oh, you know, I'll come down, you know, maybe once a month, I'll either deliver a session or you deliver and I'll play in the session. And then when the players come up to the first team, I'll be the link. And, you know, she was down every single week. There was just such a good link. And I got to know her that way. And I thought, you know, she really cares. And, you know, I knew her as a person. I got to know her, and I got to know how kind of she worked as well. So when she called me, when she took over at United and said, you know, I want you to come in and run the academy, it was really clear for me. It was a no-brainer, because I knew that it would be a club that wanted to support, you know, players holistically. It was more than just football. And so it was one of those where values kind of aligned, visions kind of aligned, and I knew, you know, if Casey was coming in, it was going to be the very best, and that was all that she would stand for. So you know, that was first and foremost the main reason why I came over. It was really exciting to be able to be that link between the girls and a professional team. And we'd spoken previously, we've already spoke about it on the pod around the development of the girls' game. And I think it happened so quick and so fast. I'd probably say after the Canada World Cup was where it boomed. Obviously with England getting to the semi-final, I think women's football kind of in some clubs and even the league, it arguably ran before it could even walk. And, you know, the playing went like this, but the infrastructure underneath just wasn't there to support it. So we were really clear. And I spoke with Casey at length and I said, look, if you want an academy that produces players to play in the top tier, it's got to be full time. Because if the first team is training full time, the 21s has to train full time. Otherwise, you're never, ever going to bridge that gap. So we spoke about the physical gap, the tech gap, psych, emotional, you know, all these things that of why the players needed to be in full time. So the program started full time. I was the only full time member of staff. My other staff were part time staff. And then this season, as part of the next stage of the progression of the academy, four of my staff went full time, five including myself, to make sure that we, in every way possible, you know, can support the players. We have a wellbeing coach, you know, who works across the first team and the under 21s and the youth academy. Without a shadow of a doubt, you know, when I'm recruiting staff, it's, you know, and Casey was brilliant at it. And you know, Mark's the same now, in the sense of there's a real understanding in the first team that we've got players in the under 21s who will never, ever play for Man United women's first team, but they still go up and train with the first team because we know it's our duty to expose them to that so that they can then go and play in another club, whether it be a Super League club or a Championship club. Because, you know, if they're coming into our programme, it's our duty of care to do our very, very best for them. And there's a lot of conversations when we recruit staff around, you know, how are you going to support the development of this person? You know, and it might even be a scenario, this player hasn't played all year, this player, you know, is bottom of the group in terms of testing, bottom of the group in terms of this. And my physical performance coach actually said something really nice to me once where we were talking about players, and he said to me, you know, Charlotte, he said, all I want for this player is for them to support them meeting these benchmarks so that when they graduate the academy, they've got the fitness to play wherever they want. He said, and if they've got that, I've done my job. You know, we can support them in terms of their next steps, but all we want to do is give these girls a foundation to then go and do what they want to do in life. And I thought that was a really nice way of putting it, to be honest.
That's fantastic.
Yeah, it's really interesting that you say after the Canada World Cup that things took off. And again, I'm coming at this from a men's game, boys game perception, but I think that was really true, because after that, on TV and in the media, the women's game was more and more prominent. So before Canada, you didn't really get that many games on TV and reported on. Whereas now, you know, you turn on Sky Sports and there's adverts for all the WSL games and the England games are live on TV. And I think there's just an acceptance throughout the population, because England's a pretty football mad country, but there's an acceptance that the women's game is a fantastic game, and it's different to the men's game. But you get a lot of people that maybe looked down the nose at the women's game in the past, now starting to realise that the level that the players are at is really high, and it's an exciting thing to watch. And you get lots more females are getting opportunities to comment on the game and be pundits and write articles in newspapers. So I just think it's progressed so much in a short amount of time.
Yeah, I always have been fascinated with how the game is growing in England versus how it grew in the States, with you all having this pro league in place. Like, having a pro league for us has been such a journey in the United States. We're on our third iteration of it. It's finally feeling like we have a solid one. Next year, we'll be launching a second level pro league called the Super League here in the United States as well, that the USL is running. But you all jumped ahead of us with this having this pro league in place without maybe all of the infrastructure that we had. I was talking to a friend of mine who's coaching at Everton with the goalkeepers, Ian, with women, and he coached in the NWSL as well. And so I was asking him, like, what's the difference between the women in England who grow up with this understanding of what it means to be a pro footballer, because you're seeing it in your culture all the time on the men, versus in the States with the women who don't have this model to follow after? And it is interesting to see how the game has evolved, but women need more opportunities. They deserve more opportunities. And it's wonderful to see your country starting to, you know, open the doors. And it has been fascinating just to sort of watch the evolution of the women's footballer coming from England compared to what Nora and I experienced, you know, just from a grassroots level, having opportunities from the very beginning for us. That sort of evolved. Like, the game grew with us. When I went to college, there was I'm guessing, like 80 Division I women's soccer programs. When I graduated from college 4 years later, there were like 300. So like the game has literally grown with us as we're Title IX babies. I was born the year Title IX was put in place. The learning journey will be different for you all. The process will be different, but it's exciting to see a result. And quite frankly, you seem a little bit ahead of us already when it comes to the top tier for women's football. So
I think it's interesting, though, because I still don't think we have the talent pool that you guys have. Obviously, I know we're a much smaller nation, but
it's interesting.
I mean, obviously, I mean, I've been out to America a couple of times coaching and, you know, visiting colleges, et cetera, et cetera. And what always baffled me was, you know, before the NWSL was kind of in a stable condition, was that, you know, young girls kind of could pay all this money growing up to play soccer and then not play after 21. You know, that used to absolutely baffle me. Now, I think we obviously went the other way. I don't think, had the participation levels we probably needed when the league went pro. And I think when you talk about the brand of the league, I think it wasn't always a great showcase for the women's game. I think you had a lot you had obviously Man City had, I think, 5 full-time players. The rest were part-time. You know, Liverpool were the first team to go full-time. And that was only probably 6-7 years ago that happened. So you had almost full-time teams playing part-time teams. You had some teams that had a couple of full-time players and were like a hybrid model. So you had a real array of results week on week, and it wasn't always a great picture. I think, you know, like we said, after the boom of Canada, I think teams going full-time, we've now got, you know, a better brand, but whereas the league is now running itself, and I think we're probably, for the first time, you know, we've got a big commercial deal. I think that our games are being broadcast in the US now. I think the game is at a place where it is a good showcase, but I still think we've got, where we will fall down is we have a huge piece of work to do around participation, because you look across even the girls' academies, the range of ability in those academies and even in teams. You know, some academies might have 1 or 2 players who've got real potential in the whole team, and I think we do have that big piece, whereas you have the talent pool because of obviously them playing through college, etc. So I do think there's things to learn from across the pond as well, because we've not got it right at universities, in my opinion. I think university football for us is a social event. It's not you know, they have the books, and you know, they have a books league, but you probably, other than the top league of books, you know, the rest, it's just a social fest. Whereas, you know, I know obviously how highly competitive yours is, and, you know, players want draft places, et cetera, et cetera. So, yeah, I think there is a big piece missing for us still.
It feels like your academy program, like where you are, when you were speaking earlier, I'm like, oh, that's kind of like college for us. Like you've found that gap with players that are in university or in college on a separate, you know, on their own, and then coming to you, versus it just all being at the same place, it being within the college environment. So it does feel like you're starting to get there. That's what I was thinking. Nora, were you thinking that when she was saying that about?
Yeah. I mean, Charlotte, for sure. When you taught, I worked with where I am, James Madison University, which is, and, you know, different from when I played there, which is the university that I played at. Now, our women's soccer program, you know, they have their academic support person, they have their nutrition person, they have an athletic trainer that is full-time women's soccer just for them all year round. You know, they've got their strength and conditioning, you know, their physio that works with a handful of teams, is not just exclusive to them, but it is true, Sky, that is, you know, that is very similar to the staff that you've got now, you know, but there is so much disparity, which is why I was asking about other clubs. You know, you could go, JMU has, you know, in the country, I've heard it said top 50 resources out of all universities in the entire country, even though we're considered a mid-major Division I school. And so our facilities are exceptionally better than when I was here. It was a training, you know, my training room experience was, yeah, just get your legs in the ice bath and take some ibuprofen and keep moving. But that ages me a little bit. So it is, but the disparity is great. You know, even some schools, most schools, even in our conference, you know, we far exceed. There's still, you know, I have 2 American football sons that are playing American football at university, and the resources, you know, two athletic trainers across 20 sports. And so it just really, it's very, it's, there's not equity in, it's just what organization puts what's amount of emphasis, what financial resources, which sort of segues me to, I don't mean to keep cutting you out, Tom, is that what is happening so much here, I think, is women are starting to take ownership for taking on the investment, taking on the ownership, taking on the, while women in women coaches in the game just continues to drop and drop and drop. I mean, I think I've seen some studies where we're below 12% of women coaching women and girls in the game, which that's a completely different podcast, Tom. But women are starting to recognize we are powerful. We have a voice. We are making money. We are, and you see now with the NWS team's shared ownership with women, you know, owners or partial owners, you see somebody like Serena Williams, Naomi Osaka, that are getting partial ownership in women's pro leagues, and the women, even players themselves, instead of in the past, oh, whatever you give me is good enough, thank you so much. It's now, no, we're, and obviously the, you know, the fight that our women's national team has taken on now, you know, the 99ers were talked about and they catapulted the women's game so far forward in our country. But this team, the Megan Rapinoes, you know, and the voice of this team, are they've been the change makers in such a different way. I wonder if the women are getting a stronger voice, and if you're starting to see if that has been part of what the growth. I heard you say way early on, you said to Casey, I need to be full-time. We need to have a full-time staff.
Yeah, it's interesting because I think a lot of the work that, you know, the 99ers, the, you know, the US national team now, women's national team now, I think a lot of the work that they've done, you know, that's really prevalent in women's football over here. You know, it's a loud voice for everybody, you know, even all the way across the pond. And I think we speak about it a lot. I'm on a course at the minute with all the WSL managers and some national team managers, and it is all around, you know, supporting women into high performance coaching. And a lot of the talk on that all the time is around, you know, we've got to stop being grateful for what we're given. And yeah, that, you know, that was a, you know, that was a pastime, but now, you know, we're a professional team. You know, yes, it's completely different. It has to sit separate to men's football. We, you know, we are a long, long way off, you know, bringing in what the men bring in. And, you know, I always say we don't compare a 100-meter sprinter. We don't compare Usain Bolt to a female 100-meter sprinter. You know, yes, the game will be slower. Yes, women won't be as physical, but there's also mums that play in that team. You know, there's also, you know, it's completely different. So I think it has to, we had to get to the point in England where it was seen as, you know, not a different version of men's football. It's just football, and there's men's football and there's women's football. And, you know, people have had to fight for what they fought for, but I think the women's game has never been, you know, in a better place. You look at, you know, Brighton have just had the whole women's department built on the, in their training ground. You know, Leicester have just been given their men's old training ground, Leicester women. You know, our women's first team have moved to Carrington. So I think it is growing. I think, like I said, it probably grew, we could probably run before we could walk in a lot of clubs across the league. But I think now, you know, people are standing up and looking at, well, how do we support, you know, the women? How do we support, you know, the growth of women's football? And I think where the league has been clever is clubs have had to commit, because if they haven't committed and supported in resource and finance, you get left behind. So yeah, I think that voice is really prevalent, and the conversations we have, and we talk around like the heritage of the women's game a lot in England. And it was actually the anniversary the other day of the women's game was banned. The FA banned, you know, women from playing altogether. And that's, you know, wild to think about, really. But it's kind of like a celebration of, you know, where that's come from, and, you know, where we are now, that we are a long way behind that, that, you know, it's time now to kind of change the history of that, and, or learn from the history of that, not change it, and make sure that, you know, as females, we're supporting females. And that probably is the best thing for me off the back of this course, is that I've got a group of women now that I can pick the phone up to, and I know no matter what badge I've got on and no matter what badge they've got on, we all want the best for each other. Because when we mapped out the journey and the history of the women's game, everyone really has come from a similar place, and everyone's kind of wants and needs are the same in terms of where we want the women's game to go. So yeah, definitely. But I think the voices and, you know, and the things that have come out of the US has probably made the women's game over here stand up a little bit and think, yeah, you know, we've got to probably stop just being grateful as well.
Yeah. The other thing that I think is probably worth noting and thinking about is that you all are, and I sort of kind of hit into this earlier. It seems like in England, you all are the women seem to be like following after the men or copying the men. Like, and what's been, I think, actually really brilliant about the women's league forming and it actually being the third iteration of it. So it's like, they've been really thoughtful, is that women's soccer, women's football in the United States has their own unique place in pro sport. Like what that sport stands for is much different than the MLS, the men's league, and what it means to be a female footballer has, there's a certain personality to that within the league itself. And, you know, that might be something that, you know, you all in England need to consider, like how do we need to identify our own way? Like we don't have to just follow after the men's path. We don't have to aspire to have a similar exact journey as the men. Like what we want to say is our identity as a female footballer is this, and it doesn't have to just be a parallel to the man. And that's been what I think has been so inspirational, even for me, like listening to our women's national team now, like they have taught me so much just in their ability to just harness the energy of the essence of who they are as an athlete and be proud of that and let that be enough.
Yeah, no, it's really interesting because I think, you know, the NWSL, I think it's a real powerful tool for women, like not just in sport, I just think in life. And I completely agree. It's interesting, but I don't know because I'm not over there, but my perception is the NWSL is thought, you know, the NWSL and the MLS is not particularly comparable to the WSL and the Premier League because the Premier League is just this massive entity that, you know, and you see it on social media, you know, if Sky Sports retweets something about women's football, the first 100 comments are just men battering women's football. And that's kind of the perception and that, you know, and to be fair to, you know, these broadcasts, they continue to do it. And I think in, you know, 5, 6, 7 years, you know, hopefully men will get bored of doing that and won't feel the need to constantly tell us how rubbish women's football is. But, you know, the perception is really difficult. And I completely agree. I think there has to be in the women's game some sort of USP or, you know, what are we and what do we stand for? And I think we've seen glimpses of that. You know, there's been different things that have happened in the WSL where, you know, people have stood up and, you know, not on the scale of, you know, what comes out of the NWSL, but I do think we need to get there. And it's interesting because the conversations when I meet with Nick, the Boys Academy manager, is, you know, he said to me, we're almost 80 years ahead of you in terms of our academy. So he's like, how do you get in 10 years or we've got to in 80? And I always say to him, you know, there's so many things that the boys do and you're like, yep, you know, that would be great for us and this would be great for us and we can put this into our context. But at the same time, there's so many things we don't want because, you know, if the men were asked to build football from scratch, they wouldn't have built it how they built it.
Absolutely.
So yeah. It's just an appreciation of that. And I think that's where we're probably at now is building, well, what do we want women's football to look like? What do we want our academy to be? Because a lot of academies will still be where we want to produce players for the first team.
There's a freedom in that, Charlotte, because when you were talking earlier, some of the ideas you were having, because you've almost got a blank sheet of paper, you were coming up with stuff. I was thinking, well, that's a good idea. Well, that's a good idea. And we don't do that in the boys. Oh, wow. And so there's an advantage to the boys game being so established and, you know, so strong. But then the disadvantage of that is that you can get complacent and you just get set in your ways. Whereas, you know, from your point of view, you're starting and you're thinking, well, why don't we do this with the parents? And why don't we do this with the girls? And we're not really thinking about that because things are done in a certain way and you just go along with it. So I think, you know, from things that everyone said here, that it certainly made me think about how we do things on the boys' side. So, I think you're right. It's going to be an interesting path to you establishing yourself separate from men's football over here, because men's football in England is so strong. But the people that are writing those comments that you mentioned earlier, they're just not educated. They're not informed. So they're making comments like that, and they're probably not seeing any women's football at all. And it's that process of of educating people, of making people realize that, look, this is a really good game. It's a really good product. And it's not only is it valuable in itself to watch on TV, but it's doing great things for the girls of this country. You know, my daughter's 22 years old. She's not really interested in football, but if she was, then there'd have been virtually, you know, it'd be very difficult for her to get involved in football. And she's 22. Whereas now, the young girls in England now, there's so many ways they can get involved in the game.
Yeah. And just, you know, pairing off, I think all of us have used the word, Sky used it. I think Charlotte, you used the word, and it's part of, you know, STEADY's mission statement, which is the organization that I founded, and that is empowerment. One of the neatest things that I think the NWSL, if you follow them a little bit on social media, and is that when the players, they release these, it's like the fashion entrance, you know, you always, when you're watching, if you're watching the NBA, any of our pro leagues over here, but especially the NBA and sometimes the NFL, they have photos of the guys coming into the arena. And, you know, I'm thinking about, oh yeah, well, how do I dress before I go to a game? Like I'm in my sweats and I, whatever, but you know, some of the men and some of my sons, you know, follow the fashion of Russell Westbrook or LeBron James and how they dress when they're coming into the stadium for the game. Well, the NWSL has done with the teams, whether, you know, again, it's Gotham or whomever it is, they do these sort of like fashion walks. And that may sound very like girly or sexist, but the neatest and most empowering thing about it is that you see what I was looking at something with Allie Krieger and Ashlyn Harris yesterday, and you see them come on and they all, and some of them are just in, you know, tights and, you know, really cool kicks and whatever kind of sweatshirt that is fashionable for them. And some just, and so to see another side of women showing their unique fashion styles as they're coming in is like a very unique and cool expression of themselves. So even Tom, you're talking about your 22-year-old daughter or the players that, who knows if they even are footballers, but now they can be like, oh, I'm going to start following, you know, Ashlyn Harris's style and where does she get her stuff and where does she shop? And I think that becomes, we're using our beauty in a very cool way to, in a very diverse way of expressing, like you can see the different ways that the women are dressing and across, you know, they really are showing their personalities. And that's another way of expressing ourselves, our strength, our beauty, and also attracting, whether it's footballers or non, you know, girls that can look up and say, oh, that's so cool. Like I have those sneakers, or I'm going to go get Air Force Ones, or, oh, I love those high boots, or whatever the case may be. And it just, I think it's a very smart way of using our intelligence. No offense. I think girls are just way smarter than boys. And I gave birth to four boys, so I have the right to say that, I think.
No argument here.
But, you know, and so it is, it's like our uniqueness. I think we're just starting to find our platform of uniqueness and beauty and power and voice. And I think the concept, Charlotte, of like, yeah, I'm going to like, I think I started following, I'm not sure, but just of collaboration and communication. You know, we need to be doing more of that in the States, but oh man, the idea of doing that more across the pond in the women's game. Funny enough, a former mentor of mine is the head of analytics. So he and Casey, I'm sure, are going to develop a really good relationship. So he was just hired by Jill Ellis. He just moved to San Diego. And so I'm going to be constantly picking his brain about Casey. And you know, I've known Jill Ellis from a long, long, long ago in our early days, just coaching in Region One. But I think the collaboration and the communication and the building up of one another and finding our unique gifts and being really comfortable with that, because sadly, in what I do, I see so many girls that lack, they are not comfortable saying who they are and what their unique gift is. And that is, honestly, it's the same between a 13-year-old girl I work with or a college girl, you know. I'm sitting down and starting my, you know, mental skills session with the JMU women. And my question is opening this worksheet that we were going to do is, hey, what is my unique gift? You know, what is my superpower? And instead of saying it, you know, they're turning to their friends and teammates and saying, well, what is my unique gift? Well, you know, I think we've done something wrong. If you're, you know, a 20-year-old college Division I athlete paying at a strong program and you're not comfortable. You may even, you know, I'm sure you know, but you're not even comfortable saying that. So it's like we go from the best of what we're becoming and what we can be. And then I think going all the way back to seeing girls and young women that just, we have to help them find their power and their voice at such an earlier age and connect, you know, to know that there are strong, powerful, beautiful, amazingly skillful women out there that they can feel comfortable, that we can be those things.
And Charlotte, I'm interested following on from what Nora's saying there, growing up in England, and obviously being a football fan and things like that, is, were your role models, were your idols or your mentors, were they male or were they female?
Yeah, they were male. You know, growing up, there was no girls teams. My family, I'm Scottish, so my dad's a massive Celtic fan through sins. And, you know, I grew up supporting Celtic and just loved football. My whole family were football mad. I've got a twin brother. So, you know, I just grew up playing football with the boys. And, you know, when I was 11, we weren't allowed to play in boys' teams anymore. So there was kind of nowhere to go because there wasn't really girls' teams. I found a girls' team a couple of years later. But, yeah, I think all my coaches growing up were male. I guess what I would say is, you know, when I think about football role models, I also think about people who positively influenced me, and some of them were teachers. Teachers played a big part for me. And I think that's probably, you know, I had a really good teacher who was amazing for me. And I think a lot of, you know, how I try and be and the characteristics and soft skills I try and show in my role as an academy manager come from what I learned from her. And almost like being the adult you needed when you were a kid is probably where I try and place myself. You know, sometimes it's an arm around the shoulder, sometimes it's a rocket, depending who the player is and, you know, what they need best. But it's knowing your people, isn't it? But yeah, definitely. I think I had, in terms of actual coaches on the grass, they were all male. I didn't have a female coach until I was 17. But yeah, and in terms of people who've influenced me to work in football, I think, and to be where I am now, I think, yeah, we're probably more teachers than coaches, if I'm totally honest. And I think it's also a piece of like the good bits of people. But then, like, I've had coaches too where I'm like, I don't want to be like you. And I learned just as much from them as I learned from, you know, the people I did want to be like.
And I'd hope that the young girls today in England, that's not going to be the case, you know, that they will see females in positions of responsibility, coaching or running teams or you know, playing and being on TV. And like I say, the commentators and so on, that they think, well, I can do that now. You know, 20 years ago, the thought of being a journalist and writing about football, if you were female, was just non-existent. Whereas now you've got people that are doing that. So if you're a young girl in England interested in football, there's lots of different ways that you can explore that. Whereas before, say, it was not there. So that's progress. But, you know, it needs to come a long way still. There's still a lot of progress to be made.
I think it links to what Nora was saying as well, because I think the visibility is huge. You know, I used to joke with Casey. I used to say to her, I used to have a picture of her on my bedroom wall. And she's like, God, don't say that. It makes me feel old. But that you know, that cohort of England players, you know, if, you know, I mean, Casey was really young, but, you know, Kelly Smith, Hope Powell, that was the first I'd really ever heard of England women. I didn't even know there was a England women's national team. So you talk about the voices now. When you were talking, Nora, I was thinking about when Tobin and Kristen were over, and obviously they have re-ink, and, you know, the girls were all in re-ink sliders, and even the 21s were like, well, you know, what's re-ink? And it's just little things like that, that it's the visibility of it. And it is, and I think the players in the NWSL do it a lot better in terms of having a brand and an identity that young girls can relate to. And I think the voices that they have and what they stand for and what they fight for and the visibility on social media, whether it's, you know, the Black Lives Matter stuff, you know, we have rainbow laces, but like the LGBTQ plus things that they do, everything that they stand for, I think they have, you know, every kind of different, you know, thing that they can stand up for, I think they do across the sport. And I think it's really important for, you know, for young girls all over the US, but it really does trickle over here as well.
Yeah, and one thing, Sky, as part of the soccer parenting, is that sense of community as well, that you want to develop. And I think this, again, is if girls can feel that in England, as well as the States, can feel they can be part of something in the local area, I think that's really key too.
Yeah, Absolutely. A lot of the club education and coach education that I do is around the research, the solid research about sense of community theory. And, you know, there's like, I'm reflecting on this as everyone's talking, because what we're talking about is how we establish a strong community that ultimately is one that empowers young women. And at the end of the day, you know, inspires them, whether or not that means to continue playing or not. And of course, with the work that we're doing at Soccer Pairing, it also layers into those younger players, those grassroots players, having a strong sense of community, boys and girls, but across the sport, so that they feel a deeper connection. Because what's often lost as we're talking about, you know, how many academy players graduate into the pro team, or what college scholarships we get, or what way too often is lost, and what is the problem structurally with soccer and football, I think, is this lack of a deep love of the game. And we've somehow bypassed that, and we've lost that in the mix of this development and this, that, whatever it is. And so I think that sense of community theory and the research behind that, this concept of, you know, you need to have a sense of belonging to a group and group membership, where that would be like personal investment, boundaries, you feel emotionally safe in this group, and there's this sense of belonging. So, you know, that's foundational to this, having the sense of community, this group membership. And then, you know, are your needs being fulfilled, which is exactly what we've been talking about today, is how do we identify properly and serve the needs of players or parents that are within this ecosystem that we have? And then the last two components of this concept of group membership are influence. And that's often about boundaries too, like giving parents influence in the space, giving players influence in the space. It's exactly what we're talking about these pro players, like having influence in the environment that they're creating for themselves in terms of how they're impacting those around them. And then having a shared emotional connection. So, you know, those are the components of what makes a great community. And whether or not that's a grassroots, whether or not that's in your academy program, or whether that's on it, it's at a collegiate program, whatever, this is what we want. This is what football really is so powerful, in that it can help us feel a deeper connection to something larger than ourselves, and feel a deeper connection to having a purpose. And, you know, that's what we need to keep coming back to. And so at Soccer Pairing, that's what, you know, a lot of the education that we do. And it's awesome for me to listen to conversations like this and be a part of them, because it's just affirming that the research around what we need to be the ultimate aim of the organizations that we're developing, regardless of the level they are.
Yeah, that it's I was really fortunate to go on a trip to Mexico, and it was a social change model. It was completely based on the research that you were talking about, Sky, but that those connections start with individual identity, you know, and that I think that's at Steady, that's what we're trying. I'm trying to get girls and build individual, reprogram the communication that I think so early on social media and in our environments, what the girls see, they're looking at all these visuals on social media, and they're around school, and I'm not pretty enough, I'm not smart enough, I'm not. And so this is the vocabulary. I don't know. I'd be so interested, Charlotte, in hearing if some of the younger girls have these issues. And so in the Steady Academy, we're training a completely new vocabulary. It's every, you know, we're debriefing constantly. What did you do well? What can you do better? It's being specific about the community. What did somebody else do well? You know, it's being a student or a leader or a teacher in every moment, right? At 12, 13, 14, 15, it's not asking anyone to be a captain for the whole season. It's asking you to be a leader in a moment. And what does that mean? So that they all learn those skills. They learn how to comfortably be able to sort through a conflict of, hey, I need you to step up in this moment for this 8 to 10 minute exercise, and you need to lead your team in a positive way. So it's, you know, rebuilding their own individual strength so that now they can come into a small group or a team or a community and be ready to offer their best. You know, it's like we can't, until we can build or help rebuild or identify and find and grow the strength in the individual, it's going to be a fractured community, which we've all been a part of, a fractured team environment where we're going to be launching a women's forum with Steady in January. And so we brought together a leadership group this past Monday. I pulled about 12 of our players that have been really involved from age 13 to 21. And the feedback, and two of the questions I asked: what were the qualities in your best team environment? What were the qualities in your worst team environment? And whether I read what I got back from a 14-year-old or a few of my college women, it is like leadership, clear communication, clear expectations, common goals, you know, unconditional support. And then the negative is the gossip, the clicks, you know, the lack of clear communication from a coaching staff about what is expected, an incapability of feeling like I can express my own individuality. And so we've talked about all these things and, you know, how we work together collaboratively across the pond, across organizations and countries. And because to me, it's not any one club, just Manchester United alone can do an incredibly special thing. But I hear, Charlotte, with the people that you've been connected, how do we cast just, you know, we can cast our pebbles, but how do we drop a bigger stone into the ocean and try to develop, you know, further develop a generation of girls that are powerful? And you know what, I think what is such a big problem over here, you said it really early on, Charlotte, is if our girls don't become college players, do they now stop playing? So we have these incredibly high participation rates at very early ages, then we start to see massive drop-off numbers starting at 13 and 14 years old. Oh, well, if I'm not making the top team, then I stop playing, as opposed to what are all these environments? You know, I feel super blessed. I'm still playing in competitive, you know, over 50 tournaments with amazing women. And I want girls to know they can play until they can't walk. And they can be involved in the game. They can be in management. They can be in, you know, they can be in physiology of the sport of football. They can be in, you know, journalism. They can do all these other things, and their love of the game can remain through a lifetime. And they can go out and play, you know, rec, slow moving, you know, over 50, over 60, and their love of the game doesn't need to be lost because they don't excel at elite levels.
Well, Nora, that's a fantastic message. And, you know, I'm sure we can chat again. I'm hoping that maybe we will get together and chat again. And this is the first podcast that we've done on the women's game. And I'm sure we'll do many more. And hopefully you'll all come back and discuss this again, because this is a subject that's just going to keep growing and growing. And it's very important for us to talk about this and make sure that all the girls out there, whether in the United States or in England, are receiving the messages that are in this podcast. So thank you so much to Nora. Thank you, Sky. And thank you, Charlotte, for a fascinating discussion on the Go Play Soccer podcast. Thanks, ladies.
Thanks for listening. And if you have a question or comment for us, or if you'd like to take part in one of our podcasts, please email podcast@goplaysoccer.com.